Hello, and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, the podcast where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. Every week here on the podcast, we invite a new female filmmaker, or a pair of female filmmakers, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their favorite genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. I'm film critic Katie Walsh, and today we have writing-directing team and my dear friends, Bridget Savage-Cole and Danielle Crudy.
Hi, I'm Bridget.
Hey, I'm Crudy.
Welcome to the pod.
Yay. Hi, Katie.
Happy to be here.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Bridget and Danielle before we get into it and the movie that they chose to talk about this week. Bridget is originally from salty Beverly, Massachusetts, and she attended Wesleyan University, where she discovered a passion for choreography and cinematography and began creating her own DIY projects. After moving to New York City, she began creating videos for Nylon magazine, as well as shooting and directing music videos for bands such as Future Islands and Hearts. In 2011, she was selected to participate in AFI's Directing Workshop for Women, where she directed the award-winning short film Uiwana, co-written by Danielle Crudy. Bridget has directed national commercials for brands including Target, MasterCard, and Spotify, and she has also created original narrative content for Funny or Die and Refinery 29, where she premiered her short Swell, starring Gabriel Luna and Britt Lower. Danielle also studied film studies at Wesleyan University and then moved to New York City, where she worked in the indie film world and at a camera rental house, and also as the assistant for Oscar-nominated director of photography Matthew Libatique on films such as Black Swan. Blow the Man Down is Danielle and Bridget's first feature, and they will also make their television directing debut on the upcoming CBS All Access series adaptation of Stephen King's The Stand. So, let's get into it. Today, Bridget and Danielle have chosen to discuss the 1973 folk horror classic, The Wicker Man. So, why did you choose The Wicker Man?
We have a couple different reasons. I know Bridget's got more of a personal connection, but when we were making Blow the Man Down, she said, I've got to screen this movie for you. You haven't seen it?
Yeah, I had this thing where I was like, wait, we were making this movie set in Maine in the boonies. And I was just like, and we have sea shanties in our movie. And so I was like, I really think you guys are going to like this movie. And everyone was like, yeah, original, blah, 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 old movie. Nobody cares. And then we were in prep, and I just put it on one night, and I think, Crudy, you watched the whole first half of it standing up, because you were basically in the state of like, I'm not going to watch a movie tonight. I'm just like going to go to bed.
For the record, because we were in production, you know, in prep.
My point is, this movie has this phenomenon of just like, once you start watching it, you can't stop.
Oh, totally.
And I feel like ended up being like a real bonding moment for us. Everyone who's in the house, we watched it with our cinematographer, Todd Van Hazel, and Danielle Mandel,
our coordinator
and mascot.
And let's just say it climaxed with us like doing the dance of the maypole in our living room to the soundtrack, which became the soundtrack of our lives of Blow the Man Down.
It's really true. We played for the rest of prep on Blow the Man Down. We would play the soundtrack like unironically and like dance around the kitchen.
Oh my God, amazing.
It was like a spiritual like mascot film for us, I think.
Yes.
It's really not like a reference necessarily,
right,
but it channeled some sort of bigger, you know, storytelling with a capital S and sort of this like timelessness, and
it also is just like you're in the middle of nowhere, and we felt like we were in the middle of nowhere making this movie.
Yeah.
You're already in like crazy town when you're making a film, and you're all living in a house together in freezing cold Maine. So it really summed up sort of the craziness,
and we could really relate to like the small town. Like everybody knows everybody in this town in Maine knew we were the movie kids. We were basically the policemen, like kind of like walking around, and everybody was like, "Oh, you're the film crew," you know. So it was sort of like this, you know, the mystery of the town was definitely channeled by the movie.
They're we're not going to let you in.
Yeah, it was like, one day they just might come for you.
Yeah. Do you need to, like, describe the movie?
Yes,
I'm going to
do a little plot synopsis.
Okay.
Spoiler alert for those of you who haven't seen The Wicker Man. Today's episode will contain spoilers that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Like we always say, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause this episode and watch it, now's your chance. It is on Netflix. It's very easy to watch it. All right, so The Wicker Man, once memorably described by the film journal Cinefantastique as the Citizen Kane of horror films. The Wicker Man is a 1973 British folk horror classic, directed by Robin Hardy and written by Anthony Schaefer, inspired by David Pinner's 1967 novel Ritual. It stars Edward Woodward as Sergeant Howie, an uptight policeman sent to the remote Scottish island of Summer Isle to investigate the disappearance of a young girl named Rowan Morrison, based on a tip and a photo that he received in the mail. Obviously, when he arrives, the people of Summer Isle are like, you can't come here. You need permission from Lord Summer Isle.
Perhaps you would be good enough to explain matters to his lordship, his most particular, who lands here.
But he starts to look for Rowan, starting with her mother, going to her school, and everyone keeps claiming that she doesn't exist.
Now, do any of you recognize either the name or the photograph?
No. There's your answer, Sergeant. If she existed, we would know of her.
It's very confusing. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to stay at the Red Man Inn, where he's propositioned via song by the innkeeper's daughter, Willow, who is played by Britt Eklund. And it really seems like everybody in the town is like in heat as they're preparing for May Day, because they're just like screwing in the fields and the cemeteries. And he is a virgin and very deeply religious, and he's very, very troubled by all of this. He ultimately ends up getting permission from Lord Summer Isle, who is played by the inimitable horror icon Christopher Lee, and receives permission to exhume Rowan's coffin.
Your lordship is a justice of the peace. I need your permission to exhume her body, have it transported to the mainland for a pathologist's report.
You suspect foul play?
I suspect murder and conspiracy to murder.
In that case, you must go ahead.
All he finds inside is a dead rabbit or a hare. And then Lord Summer Isle starts to explain to him, like, why worship the old gods, and that they attribute all of their harvesting and their, you know, unique climate to the old gods and everything.
And you encourage them in this?
Actively. It's most important that each new generation born on Summer Isle be made aware that here the old gods aren't dead.
And what of the true God, to whose glory churches and monasteries have been built on these islands for generations past? Now, sir, what of him?
Well, he's dead. He can't complain.
Sergeant Howie does some investigation. I do love that this is also like an investigation, like true crime movie almost, where he's like finding out where Rowan is, and he like looks at these old photos, and he discovers that he develops the theory that she is being kept alive to be sacrificed at the May Day ritual. So then he knocks out the innkeeper, steals his costume, joins the procession. I absolutely adore when Christopher Lee is like, you call that dancing, man? Like, innkeeper.
What's the matter with you, McGregor? Do you call that dancing?
Anyway,
he's playing the fool.
He's playing punch.
Yes. Yeah.
He's playing punch.
Yes, true. Yeah. Good point. So he participates in all of their, you know, their parade, their ritual, the game where they almost cut people's heads off.
It's a game.
Yeah, it's a fun game. And then he finally discovers Rowan at the sea, on a sea cliff, and she leads him into this cave and on top of the cliff. And then suddenly everyone's there and he's like, oh, my God, I'm the sacrifice. They're going to put me inside the Wicker Man with all these farm animals and set me on fire. And he starts screaming. They start singing. He's condemning them to hell.
And ye shall all die accursed.
They're singing and singing and dancing.
Very crazy climax.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And it's like the movie's not all that scary, but the way it ends is so profoundly dark.
Dark.
And like the Wicker Man just collapses against like the setting sun, and you're like, oh God, that is, you know, like it's a quote unquote horror movie, but there's not that much horror in it.
I feel like you know that guy is fucked from like the moment he first sees the guys on, you know, on shore, and they're at this distance, and you're just like, this guy, as soon as he lops that little anchor, you know, he like throws his pathetic anchor out. You're like, oh God, this guy is
doomed.
Just doomed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because as I was watching it, obviously thinking about your movie, I mean, there's so many weird parallels to Blow the Man Down. I mean, there's the musical element because you have sea shanties sung by fishermen that are woven throughout your film. And there's this musical element of these like ancient you know, folk songs, but also new folk songs, which were created by a band called Magnet, that was created for the purpose of making this soundtrack. And they also are like...
Is that the corn rigs and barley rigs?
Corn rigs and barley rigs. What a jam.
Corn rigs and barley rigs.
Corn rigs and barley rigs and corn rigs are bonny. I'll not forget that happy night among the rigs with Annie.
I love it when there's a refrain, like you're pretty deep in like his little journey already, and then there's just like a cut to like a refrain of corn rigs and barley rigs.
But shit is
fucked up already, and you're like, wait a minute, corn rigs and barley rigs.
It's like such benign music.
So wrong.
Magnet is considered to be a major influence on neo folk and psychedelic folk. Obviously. You
Magnet.
Know.
Didn't know I was such a fan.
I know.
Yeah.
So why did you guys decide to include these sea shanties in your film? I mean, it really does give it sort of like an ancient historical vibe to the film. Mm-hmm. And then also really connects it to the place. I think Blow the Man Down like creates such a sense of place of this like New England fishing town so well. So what were the sea shanties always there?
Thank you. Yeah. You want to take it?
They really were. From the very beginning of the Blow the Man Down journey.
Yeah.
The sea shanties. It was always called Blow the Man Down. And I attribute, you know, the idea of the sea shanties a lot to Bridget because she has like a really rich musical background. She's a great singer. She's just like grew up with a lot of music and was like, oh, because we knew we wanted to do a fishing town. And Bridget was like, yeah, sea shanties, you know?
But I feel like you were the most committed to the song once it was in there. And I was like, I don't know, is this weird? And
I was like, oh my God, I love it.
Yeah, yeah. And like, also I really give you making, like really sticking to the fact that we needed the bookends too of the Blow the Man Down at the beginning and the end.
That is the movie.
But yeah, so, you know, we were starting to write the movie, and we knew Fishing Town. We kind of, that was one of the things we both like bonded over, where we were like, we literally got together and we're like, let's write a feature today. Like, let's start it. And what do we write about? And we're like, well, we both have sisters and we both were really attracted to fishing towns from our own past. And so then we started listening to sea shanties. And I think the song title already felt like it foretold some sort of plot and like it was juicy. And I think we were just, yeah. Really,
we thought it was
it
a powerful
name,
yeah, but we obviously didn't know what the movie was about.
Yeah,
then. But it really was like the first day. It was like day one, like Blow the Man Down. Cut to 8 years
but
later.
But I think weirdly, I associate it with the same thing. Like, I mean, I feel like we wrote this movie over years because it was like one of the first and last things we worked on together. We learned how to write over the course of this movie. So it had many different chapters and phases. And I feel like there was this whole other phase where like we're pulling like reference images and we were always, you know, Crudy's so good at pulling images and she like pulled all these amazing paintings of like just like a woman standing in front of the ocean or
like a lot of Winslow Homer.
Winslow Homer and like other like just amazing things with like the ocean and like this timelessness. And so I think I always put them in the same like spiritual family of what the movie wanted to be, where we wanted it to be a modern tale, but we wanted it to have this like spiritual core that had like this timelessness to it. And I think the shanties really helped us feel like this is a tale, but it's any tale and it's any woman and it's any town kind of thing. So that was like the juicy part of it for us.
Yeah. I also feel like there's some interesting parallels in the policemen in your film.
Whoa. I never thought about this.
Because just to be clear, like, Crudy had never seen Wicker Man until we were in production.
I know. I think that's so interesting.
Truly.
That you guys like were not.
And I had forgotten about it. And I when I think about how it influenced us, I was like, because when we actually watched it, we were talking a lot about like faces. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They have all these faces in it. The faces help sell the town, too. And that was like one of the things we took from the movie.
Oh, my gosh. You know what else I was thinking when we were watching it is we always talked about how like kind of from Godfather, when there's extra people in a room, it makes it more intimidating. Makes the conversation more intimidating.
Yeah.
And that opening scene where the policeman goes up and there's those guys, you know,
all the old men,
but a lot of them don't talk.
Yeah.
But man, that pack seems so intimidating.
Yeah.
And I remember we were talking. I mean, this is a version of Well, the Man Down that has like 10 times the budget. But these scenes with women having the conversations were always like, yeah, and it's like a big room with like a lot, like there's just women in the background just not saying anything.
Oh, yeah,
just,
like the version of the where it was oh, like yeah. 20 women in the
like 20
Susie
women.
Gallagher
a lot
scene.
Of them don't talk. They're just intimidating. And like cut to like a budget like slash.
You're like, or three.
How yeah. about three? Yeah. Three? Does three work?
Listen, June Squibb, Annette O'Toole, Marceline, you know, Hugo. Like,
yeah.
That's enough.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
But there was stuff that then seeing it in Wicker Man. Also, that opening was really, I remember watching it in production, or like we were just about to go into production.
Yeah.
That opening with the seaplane and the remoteness that they really set the context up so well. That really stayed with us. We were like, wow, we got to think about that.
It's worth it to like slow things down at the beginning to really show you're in the boonies.
Mm-hmm. And just set the scene, like, you know, this place is surrounded by water and where there's nothing else around.
Yeah.
Right. Where he tries to leave Sergeant Howie tries to leave, and the guy's like, yeah, someone could row you to the mainland. It'll take a week.
I know.
And you're like, and he's like, I guess I'll just stay here.
Oh my God.
Figure it out.
He's like, that's when you're like, oh, you're really
oh,
screwed.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
But I was kind of thinking about why, you know, I watch Wicker Man, and I'm just like, why isn't every movie Wicker Man? I feel like I constantly want to watch a movie that's like Wicker Man,
but
I'm like, I've seen that too many times. I need to watch something else. And then it's just nothing else is as good as that.
Nothing is as Wicker Man as Wicker Man.
No, no.
But what is that?
What is it?
Let's
je ne sais quoi.
Is it just that it follows like a loose enough framework, but has so much X factor? I mean, it's really like...
It's a procedural, so you have a very, clear through line.
Yeah.
So you're not like lost, but then you're totally exploring this world. I feel like filmmaking, a lot of it is to people... I mean, I feel like watching movies, a lot of it is we want to explore a world we've never been into.
Mm.
And I think that is big time with Wicker Man. You're like, yeah, I am interested in like old pagan societies.
Yeah. Right.
Especially when they're having like weird like fuck fests.
Yeah.
Like outside.
The act one fuck the fest freeze one, frame.
Yeah. It's like, the freeze frame.
It's like,
I noticed all the women were on top.
Yeah. I noticed too. I made a note in my notebook about it. I was like,
women
all
on
top.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk about, we're going to dig in on Willow's seduction scene.
Oh, so exciting.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, I'm Graham.
And we're two house DJs who have been trapped inside our drum machine.
We love it here, and we'd love if you stopped by and visited us every week on Stop Podcasting Yourself
here on MaximumFun.org.
We're just a couple of doofuses from Canada.
And listen to our show or perish. Stop Podcasting Yourself
on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. We are talking The Wicker Man with Blow the Man Down filmmakers Bridget Savage Cole and Danielle Crudy. And we were about to just really dive into one of the best, most memorable scenes of the film, which is when Willow, the innkeeper's daughter, played by Britt Eklund, attempts to seduce Sergeant Howie with a siren song in the middle of the night. And she dances naked in her room and like bangs on the wall. I do love that the percussion comes
so
from
good.
Her banging on the wall.
Yes.
I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in a movie before. I don't know. Have I? Like, I don't know.
That is the scene where if you've made it to that scene, there's no way you're not watching till the rest of the end of the movie. Like, cause you're like, I feel like it's also, it strikes you where you're like, it's the first time there's nudity in the film, I think? Or no, is it
there's,
after,
well,
it's,
before, they,
it's after the fuck fest.
Yeah, it's after the fuck fest.
Yeah.
But it's so casual.
Yeah.
It's such a casual nudity.
Casual nudity. It's got like just like also like a weirdo factor too. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's just something kind of like...
Like it's not totally sexy. It's yes. just so strange.
Yeah.
What's happening.
It's like a little doofy. The rhythm is never quite on beat. And like she's banging this thing. But also it's just juicy some level too. It's like this repressed Christian guy doing this like... dance of agony and repression on one side, and he's like, you know, like smelling the door and like pressing himself up to it, and then he like she's on the other side of this door like knocking and singing and beckoning him.
I think that's where you're actually like, this guy is, he is capable of being tempted,
right?
Yeah. This story might get juicier. The scene is shot really bizarrely too. I mean, when the innkeeper shows up, right, there's such a wink when she first gets introduced.
Yeah.
And you're actually aligned with, like, the people in the inn watching him be introduced to her. And it just feels like everybody's like, okay, buddy, good luck.
Oh, you she's know? Like, literally presented as, like, here's your sex tonight.
Here's your sex, your side of sex.
Yeah.
And then the scene is shot where
they sing a whole song about it.
Yes, yes. They do.
She's innkeeper's daughter.
She's kind of mugging the lens.
Yes.
You know what I mean? She kind of is looking into the lens, which is really doesn't happen a lot of other places in the movie.
Yeah.
And there's that weird shot where she's kind of like the most dead on, and it goes out the window, and she like blows the kiss out the window, and the camera floats. I mean, it's a really bizarre perspective.
There's also some strange cuts just because they use a body double when it's full body. And that I only noticed this watch, or maybe I've seen it before, because I was like, you know, it's just so funny when they cut to the wide, too, because, like, the dance moves are just funny.
Yeah.
The dance moves are
They don't go with the song.
They don't go. They're not on rhythm with the song. She's like, you know, it's like this big naked butt, like, like swooping around and, like, knocking on the doors.
Please come, say hello.
Like, okay, so this is also, like, speaking of the scene, bringing back, so Katie Walsh and I have a mutual friend, Edith Zimmerman, who is my old roommate, and after we both watched this movie together, we used to do that dance, like, like when we were, like, moving between each other's rooms, we're roommates, and, like, we would do that, like, boom, 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 boom,
like
boom,
the
boom,
smacking.
Boom. And it's, like, moving your ass and just, like, being, it's, like, really, like, a butt-forward dance.
Yeah.
It's butt-forward, but the smacking is also, because it's, like, she's just, like, patting and smacking.
Yeah. It's, like, awkward dance moves, and then, like, this body double butt, and then like this, and then all of a sudden they will just cut on a head turn to the close up of the other actor,
of the guy,
the girl.
Oh,
like the to Britt,
the close up to Britt, mm-hmm. And then she—that's like, I think that's like this big moment where then all of a sudden she's staring right at camera.
Yeah, it's really tripped out, and this is, well, as a Catholic woman,
it troubled you to your core.
I was like, I remember the feelings.
Just like the shame and the guilt and stuff. Yeah.
And like really, he felt like he's so committed that scene. He's really committed.
He is.
He's like sweating and just so like when he's staring at the door, it really is like his most intense moment in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And it really, okay, also the landlord daughter I was thinking about, know, the song that introduces her, they go to these crazy low angles.
I know.
And that's when you're like, there are, because I love low angles.
Low angles.
But also it was just like such a horror. It felt like such a horror low angle of you are so screwed, dude. Like I feel like there's keeps being these little things of like
the grotesque.
Like good luck, man.
That
like,
was very Little Mermaid, Les Poissons kind of energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Totally.
Which is a big reference for us
big
in
Golden Down.
Really?
Yeah.
Les Poissons?
The original
Les Poissons from the Disney movie. We watched it as a reference for the opening fisherman sequence.
That in tradition from Fiddler on the Roof, the movie version?
Yeah.
Oh, as to how you wanted to sort, how you wanted the song to feel, or
the
how you wanted to shoot it?
The opening fisherman sequence. Yeah, how we wanted it to look, where it should really be like almost... almost like larger than life kind of framings.
And
makes sense.
And like, I don't know if this word is right, syncopated. Like,
there's
like, something where there's sound kind of like, you know, the almost like the banging on the
image,
doors.
Yeah, yeah. Like that the images have rhythm kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Deep, good. Deep
Les Poissons.
Of course. Okay. I mean, how could you forget?
Yeah.
My favorite part about the Willow thing is like the next morning when she goes to wake him up.
Yeah.
And she adjust the picture, because there's that moment when he's in bed and you're like, did that happen? Was it a dream? Are we in his subjectivity?
Yeah,
like, did they feed
him
something weird? And then she just does the little thing and they don't play it up. She just adjusts the picture.
I know you were struggling.
Yes.
Yeah. I know you were struggling. She's like, I called to you last night.
Yeah, you never came.
You never came.
Her, I do have to say, her accent is questionable. And I heard that she was dubbed.
Whoa.
But
I feel like the whole movie's dubbed. Is that just me?
Well, I don't know.
But, she is Swedish, and she's, like, doing, like, a Scottish accent. But I heard that she was dubbed. I don't know. I'm like, the whole thing was a little awkward.
Oh, there's whole moments where she's saying lines and her mouth is not moving at all.
Yeah, that's what I literally feel like that's the whole movie, honestly.
I did remember one point, it's like, would you like to get up this morning? And I was like, her lips aren't moving.
Yeah.
Like, it was something really simple.
I do feel like there is a tone that you guys achieve in Blow the Man Down, which is kind of like a quirky, almost like what's happening. Like, it's not as mischievous necessarily as what this movie is doing, but kind of like a, it's not like a dark comedy, but there's an element of sort of, I feel like the score that you have really helps with that, where it's sort of like, what's going on here in this town?
Yeah.
There's like bad, dark stuff happening, but we're also still like rooting for the people who have made mistakes and done bad things. I mean, what was the tone that you were trying to achieve in this, like, essentially crime thriller?
Yeah, I think you're describing it really well. I mean, we actually just talked a lot about how to make it fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It was really...
We were like, we want people to understand they can enjoy the stress, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there, it was...
Otherwise, it would be real dark and...
Yeah, because that movie like that can get heavy pretty fast.
Yeah.
And so we're... Mm-hmm. The music really is lightening the tone in a lot of ways. Or what we call it is like adding saltiness.
Yeah, it's salty. And it was always like the characters individually like always cracked us up. You know, just like writing them and the way they would talk. And then, of course, there's sort of this darker, heavier context of like the brothel and the murders.
Mm-hmm.
But like the personalities had a lot of life and really spoke to that sort of the fun, the joyous. And we also just wanted, we wanted to really make the movie like more like a ride. Where it's fun.
Yeah.
Brian McCumber, who did the score, really really understood that.
Yeah.
And brought it out in an amazing way.
It's such a great score.
And a lot of crazy
percussion.
He
did a lot of he like kind of, we were like, I feel like he really understood that it needed to be like real instruments and like rattly and crackly and kind of this sort of like the feeling of like, you know, being in an old shipyard.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like clanky, janky, salty.
Yeah, like a kind of like an old fisherman who like smiles and no teeth, but he's like laughing.
Yeah,
like, that's like
that's like,
you know
what
I mean?
We wanted
like,
the movie to feel like.
That's what
like,
feel like.
Make the score an old fisherman with no teeth.
But you know what? It
was like someone got that and made that.
He
really did get that. So
that's amazing.
Fun fact, Wesleyan fun fact, he recorded all the instruments in Crowell Concert Hall.
Yeah.
Nice.
He lives in Middletown.
It's a deep cut for a very specific listening.
For the Wesleyan alum.
But
so both of you have like a camera cinematography background, but you have a cinematographer, Todd Van Hazel, who shot Blow the Man Down. But you obviously talk about filmmaking in terms of, you know, shots and all of these things a lot. So how do you think that background in being DPs and in training and camera like affects your directing? I mean, obviously you have to choose the shots and everything, but it's sort of like, you know, is that...
I think getting started, it was so much... First of all, I never really like feel like I graduated to being like a DP, but but we were definitely shooters and we were constantly shooting. And I think initially it was really good to give technical confidence. And I think this is a very specific feeling when you're on set. And oftentimes when we were starting, we'd be like, you know, one of the few women. And I think when you have technical knowledge, it gives you confidence and it gives you ability to ask for what you want. And it's pretty common, probably in any field, that sometimes when people don't want to do something, they give you a technical reason why they don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And so if you have the technical knowledge, then you can actually understand.
You can challenge
or understand or
you're arming yourself.
You don't feel like at the mercy of things you don't understand.
Yes, that's
and so I think that's
huge.
Like really was like really important to us personally. I mean speaking for myself for sure, and then I mean Todd has like just elevated it so much for us too, and I think
Yeah.
One thing I always hear from you, Crudy, and I like really believe in, is sort of like this conviction that shots matter. Mm-hmm. That shooting something with a long lens feels different from a wide lens, and that having this like this kind of a composition is going to feel like this, and this is going to align you with X, and this is going to align you with Y, and to really understand that shot scales and lens choices matter for story reasons.
Yeah, for story.
Yeah.
And I think that was like actually the journey of, you know, having a camera background to the role of, you know, being the director, writer, you know, doing with Bridget. Like, I actually feel like it was forgetting a lot of the camera stuff too, letting go of that, because there's a lot there, you know, you really have to just think about storytelling, and you have a, that's why it's great to have a DP that you trust. And we've worked for Todd, you know, we'd worked with Todd in a lot of different circumstances. I worked as Todd's AC in the past. So really trusting him to be on, you know, the lighting and to like be on the LUT and be, you know, captain of the technical team so that you have more freedom. So it was like, I mean, I definitely made shorts where I got too obsessed with the gear and the camera and just like so into the camera that I was forgetting like about story stakes and emotion. And so weirdly, the arc is like let go of some of that stuff, which actually I've really, once you get older, you let go of some, like I just, I'm like, man, I really forget a lot in this kind of like sad way, but also it's just maybe somewhere in a different,
it's in a different
utility.
Thing. I think it's actually understanding like, you can describe a feeling and the DP should get it.
Yeah.
And then if you're, if something's not aligning, you can troubleshoot with them, but also like, it's really, it, sometimes it is a curse to know, to be asking too many questions about lenses and blah, blah, blah. I've definitely tried to let
when
go of that.
When you're trying to focus more on story, performance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but, and also trusting, just be like, even though you pictured it on this lens, maybe it's fine in this.
Right. Yeah, because it can get really, it can get really literal when you, when you're imagining scenes with your mind lens, as we call it. So, but also in reality, things are different and there's different compromises to make. So, but I think you're really smart, Bridget, about articulating that having the knowledge helps you troubleshoot.
Yeah.
So knowing, you know, that you can shift a couple lens, like knowing to ask, maybe the maybe why it doesn't look right is the lens. And I've seen you do that so much. And it's really like, it's always remembering that that can be one of the factors to troubleshoot.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we will take another break and we'll come back and talk more Wicker Man.
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Baby, this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for maximum fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. We are talking about Wicker Man. And one thing we wanted to talk about was sort of the like cultural influence of this movie, which when you watch it, it's like kind of a small-ish, like it's not a huge story, but it has an outsized influence. I think, I mean, I mentioned that I always want to watch movies that look like Wicker Man. And it does, it is sort of like the original like quote unquote folk horror. And obviously there was a very popular folk horror movie.
What are other folk horror movies?
So I was reading an article that they, it's this one and then a movie called The Blood on Satan's Claw, which is
Have you seen it?
Shudder, and I will be watching it hopefully soon. And then I don't know what the I don't know what the other one that they mentioned it was is like, but I really want to see The Blood on Satan's Claw. But it's kind of becoming like more like popular. I mean, they're obviously Midsommar last year. Ari Aster's Midsommar was a huge, hugely influenced by The Wicker Man. And it's interesting because people will say, oh, well, I'm like, I just want to watch Wicker Man. And people will say, well, what about Midsommar? And I'm like, yeah, but it's just, I don't know. It doesn't scratch the same itch. I know. Maybe I just need like a prudish police officer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different, like, it's a different fish in the water. Yeah.
But it's the same, it's like a similar, it's the same water. It's similar water.
Similar
totally.
Water.
Yeah.
Different fish.
I think, I loved Midsommar.
Yeah.
And I just thought that I loved the folk art that they used
art
in
was
it.
Amazing.
Was so cool and so good.
And I think
so
he did a ton of research on that. So it's like super authentic.
I was looking at this Swedish folk art exhibit in Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm from. And gosh, I mean, it really was like channeling all the iconography in it.
And it was like had such a wit to it, like the embroidery with like the pubes being cut into the thing. And
yeah, I mean, I think Midsommar is like
so ridiculous.
It's also, you know, it's one of those movies that it's a horror movie, but it kind of tests the boundaries of horror storytelling and kind of flips them by having everything be in the daytime and flowers and fields and
there's not as much of a wick or a wink a wick a
no
wink.
But it is like actually funny.
It is, yeah, it is funny, like the relationship of those like college dudes is
and
quite funny.
You know the scene where they make him have sex with the young girl? I mean, that's
done in a really witty place.
That has a wink. You're right. But I wouldn't say it was like the the opening, just because of the tone of the opening of the movie. I didn't really feel like it was like
the tone was heavier.
It's more like grounding you in a place of being terrified. I feel you know, I think, and not judging it good or bad for not having a wink. I just, that's one thing I think, thinking about watching the
similar
film.
Takeaways, I would say, where even though you're like, oh, this is, you know, so many of your main characters are being killed in Midsommar and you are supposed to be scared of the society, you also are won over by the society. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing happens in Wicker Man.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, it's a movie where the main character is literally terrified of sexuality, and the movie is celebrating sexuality and saying, like, fuck fest, look at these naked bodies. Like, we have got three blondes, and they've got boobs, boobs, boobs.
Yeah.
It's literally, like, the movie loves, like, nudity and, like, loves it and is celebrating it and, like, actually is like, dude, don't be a stick in mud. They're just dancing around naked.
Right.
Like, just... I feel like it's
kind of like the question is like, what are you so afraid of, dude?
Yes.
Like that's like,
what are
really,
you so scared
that's
of?
That's really the dramatic question.
One thing I did want to ask about, kind of pivoting a little bit, was, you know, Christopher Lee, who stars as Lord Summer Isle, he was really trying to get away from his Hammer horror roles as Frankenstein and Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this really established, he was actually very involved in the development of this project, but and I love his performance. I love his like wild hair.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. And it is, you know, it's in the horror vein, but it's a little bit different from what he's usually, what we know him for.
Mm-hmm.
But he has this really established screen persona. And then you in your film, you have Margot Martindale, who also has this established screen persona. So did you always have her in mind, or was that someone that you like wanted to work with, you know, her presence, her, you know, kind of strong, you know, authoritarian mama presence?
What a tee up for an answer that is going to surprise you. Well, Margot was cast very late in the process.
Yes.
And is in the story of Blow the Man Down, this person who then became like the embodiment of the
movie. Yeah, yeah.
So it's just like the tee up the journey of filmmaking of
casting is a crazy process
and scheduling.
Yeah, scheduling, and you're at mercy and people drop out and da da da. But we really feel like casting Margot Martindale was like the best possible thing to ever happen to the movie, because she is fun to watch.
Yeah.
And she has
great
swagger, and she is like carries herself like a queen, and that really
very
is like
regal,
something she has in real life. Like, she really lights up the room and is like charming and naughty and outrageous,
speaks her
yes
mind.
Yeah,
and makes like jokes like crazy,
and she's just like, so she's got so much chops too. Like, she just is like such a lifer as far as acting goes.
Yeah.
And I just, like, we just think she could do anything.
I mean, we always loved the character of Enid. You know, writing her was so much fun.
Yes.
Even though she was, you know, she's like a, quote, you know, naughty woman, and she's has, like, her moral compass is broken. But she was really fun to always put in a scene and was, like, this X factor. And that really is what Margot Martindale was in every scene.
Yeah.
Is bringing her own like humor and wit and just personality. so we're so thankful that, and we really give it up to Margot for seeing the role and knowing that she would knock it out of the park.
I think she really made it.
Wouldn't have come all the way to Maine.
I know.
If she didn't know, you know, and just show up for that shoot, knowing that she was like, I can do this and make you love this role.
It was Margot's role.
Yeah. I love that you said she had swagger because she really she's got her like fur and her cane and she's just like, you know, she knows, gangster moves.
Yeah, and she spends money on herself, man. Yeah. Like, I feel like that's the biggest difference between her and the other women in the town. You know, it's just like, in New England, there's such a, like, thing where you're like, oh, don't mind me, and I'm not going to make a fuss out of myself. And it kind of can, like, be stifling.
Yeah, like, don't show off. Like,
yeah, we don't show off or nothing ostentatious, you know?
Yeah, don't
and she's
call
like, she's like, I've made my money, and I'm going to spend my money, and I'm going to get my nails done, and I will be broke, but I'm wearing lipstick and have, like, a night and dress nice, you know? So we kind of
always... Well, it's like almost like a pride.
She's got pride, that's kind of like... in a culture that doesn't always, like, have women don't always have, like, a lot of pride.
Yeah.
So we just love that she enjoys like herself and her persona, and she's got her own like cult of person, like, you know, her own story she's written around herself too. You know,
Enid.
Yeah.
Oh,
she
yeah.
like sees herself as like a savior in
and
the
a
town.
Maverick.
Yeah.
And a you maverick. Know, and
yeah.
Has
yeah.
kind of like built herself in with this own narrative of, well, I made mine and.
Yeah.
The rest of you are just haters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Haters. The haters.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's about it for this episode. But thank you guys so much. This was such a fun conversation.
Yes.
Love that I got to do it with you.
Thank
Long-time
you, Katie.
Friends. Everyone watch Wicker Man and everyone watch Blow the Man Down. How can we see Blow the Man Down?
Blow the Man Down is going to be released as an Amazon original after March 20th. I don't know when
on
this
March
is
airing. 20th.
On March 20th.
So streaming on Amazon March 20th.
Yes. Included with is Prime. It... Check it out.
Watch them both.
Shout out to the candy shop in Wicker Man. We didn't get to talk about it, but
the candy shop is so good.
The giant children that you could eat.
Oh, the children you could eat. Can I do my last shout out?
Yes, Wicker
Man shout out to the opening title card that says the filmmakers would like to thank Lord Summer Isle.
I had a note about that.
I also had a note about that. Didn't get to it.
And I was like, are they pulling a Fargo?
A Fargo.
This story is absolutely true, and it's not.
It's the original Blair Witch.
It's the original Blair Witch.
Yeah. Also, could be a folk horror movie. All right.
Blair Witch?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Definitely.
All right. Well, we could do like another hour on this alone. Maybe we'll have to do a round two sometime. But thank you guys so much and talk to you soon.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org.
What's the matter with you, McGregor? Do you call that dancing?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.